Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet John Giorno. John Giorno is an artistic innovator who has been defying assumptions of poet, performer, political activist, Tibetan Buddhist, and visual artist since he emerged upon the New York art scene in the late 1950s. Giorno's poetry has morphed and changed over the decades, but always being true to a sense of the real that emerges as in what is before us, what is in front of us. Not as in realistic poetry, but real as in a sense of the spirit. His bravery in experimentation is unbroken. Giorno is considered the originator of spoken word poetry. He is the author of a number of books, including Subduing Demons in America, Poems 1962 to 2007, and You Got to Burn to Shine, from High Risk Books. In the 1960s, he began producing multimedia, multisensory events concurrent with Warhol's Exploding Plastic Inevitable. He worked with Rauschenberg's Experiments in Art and Technology, EAT, in 1966, and with Bob Moog in 1967 to 68. His breakthroughs in this area include Dial-A-Poem, which was first exhibited in the 1968 Architectural Society of New York exhibit and was additionally exhibited in the Museum of Modern Art's Information Exhibition in 1970. The first comprehensive retrospective of his work, I Love John Giorno, curated by Ugo Rondinone, opened in fall 2016 at the Palais de Tokyo in Paris. His work is part of the exhibition, Andy Warhol, My Perfect Body, which appears at the Warhol Museum in Pittsburgh from October 2016 through January 22nd, 2017. Hi, John. How are you?
Really well. Thank you.
Yeah. There's so much more to say, and it was so challenging to get parts of that down because you've accomplished so many amazing things, and we're so happy that you're here in Pittsburgh.
I'm 80 in 10 days. I turn 80 years old in 10 days.
Wow. Well, people can't see you, but you look really great. So you're going to read from an essay that you wrote called Andy's Perfect Body?
Yes. I'm writing a memoir, and this was sort of a smaller piece in the memoir at the beginning, and I reworked it as sort of an essay for the catalog of the show.
Okay, well, go ahead then.
Okay. Uh-huh. Andy's Perfect Body. In 1962, I saw Andy at gallery openings. I first met him at the opening of his first exhibition on November 3rd, 1962, at the Stable Gallery. And soon after, we became good friends. On Saturday morning of May 26, 1963, Andy and I were visiting friend and artist Wynne Chamberlain in his country place in Old Lyme, Connecticut, for the Memorial Day weekend. I had a hangover from a dinner party the night before and stayed in bed while Andy took a shower. I got up to take a leak while Andy was drying himself. I was very surprised. I stood there looking at him. He had a beautiful body. Andy was trembling, slightly frightened. It was the first time I saw him completely naked without the wig. Normally, he came to bed wearing jockey underwear and a t-shirt and always kept himself covered. All his body muscles were perfect shaped perfectly, as in classical Greek sculpture, or the cliché of Michelangelo's David in Florence. His muscles were lean and hard and sensuous, on top of which sat the Andy Warhol head, face, and wig. Andy worked all the time and took speed so he could work harder. The amphetamines caused Andy to burn off all his body fat, and the exercise of working all the time strengthened and hardened his naturally well-formed muscles. Speed was also the diet pill of the 1950s and 60s and made you not want to eat. Andy never gained any weight, no matter how much Slovakian food his mother cooked for him. Speed also gave him the good quality of being fearless, not afraid of a great idea. And being fearless enabled Andy to make the great breakthroughs in art. Andy, you have a beautiful body, a beautiful body. I was naked and put my arms around him and hugged and kissed. Oh, John, said Andy, giggling modestly. But it's true. It's just look at you. You don't see it, but your body is that of a Greek god. I paused and said, with a satyr's head. Andy was 32 years old. His skin was snow white as marble and hairless. And being hairless made his classical body look like sculpture and seem unreal. Andy allowed himself to indulge in low self-esteem and self-loathing of his body. His mind saw his face as being ugly with the skin problems, the bulbous nose, and the wig. And he looked down and also saw his body as being ugly. His naked head was quite beautiful. It was the wig that made it unattractive. Look at you, said Andy, laughing happily. We were looking at each other through Caravaggio lenses. I was 25 years old and had a naturally good body. We saw each other as having perfect bodies, illuminated by self-appearing divine light. In 1956, Andy had a nervous breakdown caused by a failed relationship with Charles Lisenby, whom Andy loved and adored but was unrequited. After traveling around the world together, Andy got sick. The nervous breakdown caused a nervous disorder, resulting in Andy losing all his body hair, the reason for the wig. He talked about having skin problems and was diagnosed with St. Vitus dance as a child. Even though he had been a sickly and puny child, as an adult, he had become a beautiful man. Morning sunlight came through the bathroom window, flooding the glossy white paint walls, reflecting the light of Andy's body, like in a Caravaggio painting. I gave him more hugs and kisses. It's true, it's true. Look at you, look at you. You are exposed. You are beautiful. That's your secret. I was about to say, you look like a skinhead, and that's hot. But I didn't, because I thought he wouldn't appreciate it. He was in a delicate state with his hands shaking and trembling. I just wanted him to feel good. Andy, you cause yourself all your problems, I said. Your mind creates all your problems. Oh, John, I don't know, said Andy, radiant. Look at yourself. We both relaxed our minds, being together without thoughts, recognizing the rare moment. Andy put on his jockey shorts and t-shirt as soon as he was dry, went into the bedroom and put on his pants, and I took a shower. 2 weeks later, on Saturday morning, June 8th, I woke with a severe hangover in my apartment at 255 East 74th Street. The night before, I had given a dinner party for six friends, and we had drunk a lot of vodka and wine. I got up to take a leak and noticed an enormous pile of dirty dishes and glasses and went back to bed. Around 11, I got up, made a pot of tea, and started washing the dishes. The phone rang, and it was Andy. "What are you doing?" "I'm washing dishes. I gave a dinner party last night. Remember, I invited you." "Oh, yes. Who was there?" said Andy. "Phyllis Harriman and Boho." Phyllis was a painter and the niece of Averill Harriman, John Myers, and Herbert Matus. John was the director of the Tibor Denagi Gallery, and his partner, Herbert, had just directed the Broadway production of Tennessee Williams' Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. "Oh, what did they say?" said Andy. "It's so hot today," I said. I didn't feel like telling him all the interesting gossip right away. "It must be 90 degrees already, and so humid. I'm sweating washing dishes." "Oh," said Andy, "do you have clothes on?" "No, I'm naked. It's so hot. Can I come over and make a movie of you washing dishes?" said Andy. "Yes, of course. I'll be right over." I lay back down on the bed and went back to sleep for 15 minutes, woke up, and went back to washing the dishes. The doorbell rang, and having forgotten about Andy, I leaned out the second floor front window of the Carriage House apartment to see who was there. Andy was wearing a white T-shirt and black jeans and carrying a shoulder bag. Andy came up. We hugged and kissed and talked. I continued washing dishes, naked. "Can I make a movie?" said Andy. "Yes, of course." From his bag, he set up the tripod, 16-millimeter Bolex camera, and plugged in the electric attachment that rewound the film. The skylight in the middle of the room gave enough light. He focused and framed and did a fixed shot for about 30 minutes, changing the film rolls six times. We gossiped and laughed. Andy stood around the camera and I continued washing dishes, naked. I understood dishwashing was an ordinary daily activity that everybody does, and that this was a work of art. Andy saw in the people around him a reflection of his own beautiful body. What he did not see in himself, he saw in everybody else. Their imperfections were beauty marks. Whoever attracted him, and potentially every person in the world, had a perfect body. It was reflected in the 1960s drawings and photos and found images and in his movies, particularly in the early 60s. The Warhol superstars had perfect bodies, chosen by Andy. Every person in his films, photographs, paintings had a perfect body. They were gods and goddesses made by Andy. In the spirit of the 1930s and 40s Hollywood movie directors and producers, Andy thought of the superstars as his creations, his invention, and he could make and break them, pit them against each other, and play with them, sometimes as a cat does a mouse. Andy created a god world of superstars. In 1963, Andy was very aware that I was aware that with sleep he was making me into an icon, the perfect body. Seeing every person in the world as a god and goddess, and how people see themselves as deities is very profound.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet and writer John Giorno, reading his essay, Andy's Perfect Body, about Andy Warhol. That's such a great essay, and it's full of energy, and, you know, I love all the sort of the real details in there. You know, I was washing dishes, I was standing at the sink, and Andy calls. I mean,
it's like real time. It's like everybody's life. And like the part that I talk about speed, this was very important, and particularly in those years, like sort of the year before, in 19, whatever that was, in 63, or 2 and 3, when he got to do the World's Fair, and he decided to do the 12 Most Wanted Men. It was a great idea, and a really weird idea, but he saw the brilliance of the idea, and the speed gave him the courage. When everybody thought he was nuts, you know, on and on, like the death pictures, it was because he realized the death pictures, like in this show at the Warhol Now, the death pictures are so brilliant. And the speed, it let him do them. And then when he realized he couldn't sell, nobody wanted to hang death pictures over their bed or in the living room, and they were a failure. Nobody bought them. He stopped, but he did that. And it's sort of, it's when he stopped taking speed after he got shot. And then in the 70s, where his work changed slightly, he had less, it was just as great, but different.
Yeah. I know that, you know, there was an influence with Andy on your work, and that you were doing some things with repetition, with montage, with found objects, with finding the life within objects for a while back then. But I want to ask you about something you said. This is a quote I have. You said, "Compassion for gay men and women has been the object of my life's work. Even before I knew what I was doing it." So can you talk about the process of writing and not knowing sort of what your work is doing at the time, and then how you know later what it has been? Since you have a lot of, you know, you've done so much and you are looking at it.
Well, that's an interesting question, because I think about it these days, and it has all the important pieces I've ever done in my life. It has happened intuitively before the fact. I mean, right now, among other things, besides things now, I wrote a poem called God is Man-Made, which is a poem about the problem, you know? And I wrote it a year and a half before Charlie Hebdo. And when Charlie Hebdo happened, the poem was formed. I said, how could I have written this? Because you can't write those poems when something like Charlie or Babylon happens, because your mind is poisoned with anger. And so I finished the poem shortly after Charlie, and then perfected it in performance. And then I had the show, I Love John Giorno, by Ugo Radinoni at Palais Tokyo, and I didn't perform at the opening. It opened in October a year ago. I didn't perform at the opening because it's Ugo's show. Yeah. And so I was scheduled to come back a month later, and I came back, and I left New York the day after Batalon happened. And I arrived in Paris the next day, and then, you know what happened. The city is in a catastrophe, in a state of shock and everything. And it was scheduled I was to perform that next Wednesday, and I did. The first day, everybody came out of their houses, and it was closed, Paris was closed for a week, came out of their houses, 1,000 people came to Babylon, and they were crying and weeping and screaming and whatever. And so I feel very lucky. I would never have been able to write the poem if I hadn't written it before, you know. And this goes back to the early 60s. Like, I was around in the very early 60s, and I saw the use of found images. And so Andy had his first one-man show in November of 62. But I had seen him at openings before, and I knew his work. And I knew Bob Rauschenberg's work, and Jazz was a very small community. And I ventured to make a found, because a found poem, basically inspired by Andy before I met him, but also Bob and Jasper and the whole world, and, you know, the pop artists. Maybe I knew the other pop artists before I knew Jasper, like Roy and Jim Rosenberg.
You're talking about Jasper Johns.
But Jasper is another. But of the pop artists, like Jim Rosenquist, you know, I knew them before I met Andy. So I understood the found image. So I went ahead and wrote these first found poems. And then they were published in C Magazine by Ted Bergam in October, September of 62. And then I didn't meet Andy until November of 62. So again, mm-hmm. One does these things almost intuitively.
Yeah, beforehand. Okay. Well, can you recite that one poem?
Oh, God is... Yes.
Okay.
God is man-made. Yes, there is a God, and it is man-made. There is a God, and it is made by man. All the gods are made by you and me. We create the gods, and they look like us. Yes, there was a moment recognizing intuitively the empty, true nature of mind, beyond concepts and inconceivable. And then we started thinking about it, thinking about it, thinking about it, thinking about it. Made it into ideas, made it into concepts, created all the self-serving religions. And then we said some words and said it was the word of God, words from God. And everybody believed it, wanted to believe it. We created God, and he looks like us. Yes, there is no hell. There are no hell worlds of devils and demons other than the hell inside my mind, the hell inside my mind, the hell inside my mind. The hell you and I create around us, the hell we create around us, the hell we create around us, and take with us into death. Yes, there is no heaven, there are no heaven worlds other than the joy of you. Living in your eyes, living in your eyes, living in your eyes, and seeing everybody in the world as gods and goddesses, every wretched, ugly, grasping person is a deity swimming in light. Yes, God's helping and making happy, helping and making happy. Demons hurting and harming is your own mind seeing itself. Yes, at the moment of death, at the instant of awareness, the gods are gone. If you go looking for heaven, you are in trouble. The gods vanish within the unborn, empty nature of mind. You are liberated through your own self-luminous awareness. Your own self-luminous awareness will always be with you. I will always be with you. I will always be with you. I will always be with you. Yes, everything is a delusion, including the most sacred. Everything is delusion, including the highest, most profound teachings. Everything is delusion, including the highest teachings that lead to the realization that everything is delusion. The play of emptiness, clarity, and bliss. Finding it through yourself, finding it through yourself, finding it through yourself, finding it through yourself. Self-luminous awareness ceaselessly coming.
Well, that was a great. That was really great. You recited that entire thing with, again, I wish people could see, but full of energy and so powerful. My question doesn't seem important anymore.
No, what was the question? The question was, it's important.
I think you just answered it. My question was, do you see movement in a poem as innately political, as in busting up the expected structure of a poem to release chaos? So I'm thinking on the page, you know.
Well, this is the God, my goddess was an example. I had no intention of going this. And if I had, like now with the things that are happening in America now with Trump and everything, if you get angry, that doesn't solve the problem. Anger is great too, because anger creates change. So anger is important. But sometimes it in our world, it sort of nullifies it. Anger doesn't work sometimes. So I don't know what. So the poem was written before the anger arose so that it worked.
Yeah.
And I find that really interesting.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I love all the repetition, but the luminosity that of humans that comes up, and it's really fills me up as a listener, and is very hopeful. Do you have a poem also about light?
Well, I have it when everyone gets lighter. Yeah.
Could you read that?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
This is called "Everyone Gets Lighter." Life is lots of presents, and every single day you get a big bunch of gifts under a sparkling pine tree hung with countless balls of colored lights, piles of presents wrapped in fancy paper, the red one with the green ribbon and the green one with the red ribbon and the blue one with silver and the white one with gold. It's not what happens. It's how you handle it. You are in a water bubble human body on a private jet in seemingly a God world, a glass of champagne, a certain luminosity and clarity, skin of air, a flat sea of white clouds below, a vast dome of blue sky above. And your mind is an iron nail in between. It's not what happens, it's how you handle it. Dead cat bounce, catch a falling knife, after endless shadow boxing in your sleep, fighting in your dreams and knocking yourself out, you realize everything is empty and appears as miraculous display. All are in nature, the play of emptiness and clarity. Everyone gets lighter, everyone gets lighter, everyone gets lighter, everyone is light. Okay.
That was great. The poetry of John Giorno, and I can't believe we're out of time. But
thank you.
Thank you so much. That was amazing.
Great. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody 90.5 WESA.